What we wanted to do with that opening video was, you know, we were very conscious that we didn't want the Mustawa meeting to be one of complaining and lamenting about the suffering of Muslim women. We wanted it to be positive and empowering. And so therefore we did that, you know, showing the verse in the Quran that really recognize, you know, equality between men and women, and showing the trajectory of law reform as well in many Muslim countries, that actually change is possible, that equality is possible and necessary as well. So this is what Mustawa wants to do, is really to create a global movement and create a very public international presence of Muslim women, you know, demanding justice and equality as part of the debate really in today's, in many of today's Muslim countries, about the place of Islam in public life and in public law and in the constitution. So really the push for democratization in many Muslim countries today have, you know, what we're seeing is, you know, and why Mustawa, the need to form Mustawa, was there is a very open contestation that's going on in many Muslim societies between, you know, an understanding of Islam as conceptualized by traditionalist ulama in and out of government, and Islamists pushing for an Islamic State and Sharia law, and human rights activists and women's rights activists. And it is traditionally believed that in Islam, God is the only sovereign and ultimate source of law. Any man-made law is therefore considered an illegitimate innovation, a bid'ah. In a democracy, of course, sovereignty lies with the people, and the people are the source of law. Thus, in the debate in many Muslim societies on the compatibility of Islam and democracy, the issues of divine sovereignty versus human sovereignty, divine law versus human legislation, have become issues of contention. In the traditional conception of Islamic law, rights are subject to classification in terms of religion and gender. There are different rights for Muslim men, Muslim women, and non-Muslims and minorities, rather than equal rights for all. This, of course, contradicts democratic and human rights principles, which recognize that all humans are equal and all rights are due to them by virtue of their humanity. Moreover, they also contradict the constitutions of many Muslim countries themselves, which do recognize equality before the law and non-discrimination and fundamental liberties. The rise of political Islam since the 1970s in many Muslim countries have brought to open contestation conflicts and contradictions that until then really had remained largely on paper. As these states and their leadership become delegitimized in the eyes of the discontented, alienated and marginalized groups of society, the reactive search for an alternative governing ideology in many Muslim countries today often takes the form of religion. And in many of these societies, Islamist activists demanding the creation of an Islamic state and for Sharia law to be the supreme law of the land have become the most vocal and effective opponents to the ruling elite, as they successfully construct and package religion into an ideology of political struggle against the unjust, oppressive state and hegemonic, omnipotent Western world, in terms of its political, economic, and cultural dominance. And to bolster its legitimacy, many governments in Muslim countries have adopted some form of an Islamization policy in response to this Islamist challenge, in order to subdue political opposition and to, of course, expand state power and capacity and to maintain its control and dominance over society. And I want to illustrate this with the example of my country, Malaysia. Which is a multiracial country, a multi-religious country. 60% of the population are Muslims, 40% are non-Muslim. But like many other Muslim countries buffeted by the forces of political Islam, the government felt it had to adopt an Islamization policy. In an escalating contest between the two dominant Malay Muslim-based party, UMNO, which is part of the ruling federal government, and PAS, which is in the opposition but in control of some states in the country, you know, to prove each other's religious credentials. And this really has brought to the open the conflicts and contradictions arising within a plural legal system, when constitutional guarantees of fundamental liberties and non-discrimination come into conflict with increasingly conservative interpretations of the religion, and in the context of rising political Islam. I will take you through three key areas of contestation as an example where these conflicts arise. First, let me briefly describe to you the Malaysian constitution and the place of Islam. The constitution provides that Islam is the religion of the federation. Malaysia is a federation of 13 states and one federal territory. But it does not explicitly state that Malaysia is an Islamic state, nor that the law of the land must be based on the Quran or the Sunnah, the traditions of the Prophet, or it must be based on the Sharia. Neither does the Constitution state explicitly that Malaysia is a secular state. However, the Founding Fathers clearly intended for Malaysia to be secular, and the decision to make Islam the religion of the Federation was primarily for ceremonial purposes. Case law in 1988 also holds that although Islam is the religion of the Federation, according to Article 3 of the Constitution, it is not the basic law of the land against which actions or laws were to be tested. This Supreme Court case characterized Malaysia's public law sphere as secular, and unless the Federal Constitution was amended to reflect the Sharia law as the supreme or basic law of the land, this would be the case. And no amendment has been made to the Constitution to change that status. Article 4.1 of the Constitution provides that the Constitution and not Sharia law is the supreme law of the Federation. Article 162, which defines law, does not mention Sharia as part of the definition of law. Article 3.4, which also states that nothing in this article on Islam derogates from any other provision of the Constitution. This means that no right or prohibition is extinguished as a result of Article 3, which places Islam as the religion of the country. But in the past few years, these explicit constitutional limits on the jurisdiction of Islamic law in Malaysia are not enough to protect the federal constitution as the supreme law of the land. Islamist ideologues determined to push for an Islamic state and imposition of Sharia law continue to test the limits of Sharia jurisdiction. While the place of Islam in the constitution remains unchanged, the political and religious landscape in Malaysia has changed, leading to new trends in interpreting the constitution. Proponents of the Islamic State project argue for the supremacy of Islam and Islamic law based on the special position accorded to Islam in the federal constitution, which it does not provide for other religions in Malaysia. And by attempts to redefine and expand the scope of what constitutes the precepts of Islam that is defined in the constitution that comes under Sharia jurisdiction, that the state could legislate to govern the lives of Muslims. What is of concern in Malaysia today for people like me, for human rights activists, women's rights activists, is that while the vote is very clear, that the voters election after election have been very clear in rejecting any kind of religious extremism and supremacist ideology, a silent rewriting of the constitution is taking place through unwritten policies, decision-making, and an interpretive judicial trend that appears to disregard the rule of law and constitutional principles, that confuses the line between private faith and public policy. So the power of the Islamist movement is not so much that it can win power and bring about regime change in Malaysia, but in its ability to affect state-society relations by changing the cultural reference points of the society and thereby forcing change in the nature of the relations between the state and society and within state institutions and interpretations of state instruments, law and policy. Let me just give you an example in one area of criminal law. One major constitutional test that remains unresolved in Malaysia is in the area of criminal legislation. When is crime a federal matter as conferred by the federal constitution from the time of independence, and when is it a religious issue and therefore under state legislation? In Malaysia, religion, Islam, is under state matter. As part of their battle to set up an Islamic state and to prove that they are more Islamic than the federal government, the Islamic Party PAS, while in control of two state governments, adopted the Hudud law. I don't know whether you are familiar with that. It's a Sharia criminal law which provides for forms of punishment for Sharia forms of punishment for theft, robbery, illicit intercourse, false accusation, apostasy, and alcohol consumption. And this includes, you know, the sensational cutting of hands and all that, these forms of punishment. These states claim to exercise this jurisdiction on the ground that under the federal constitution, Islamic penal law is in state hands on the basis that the constitution under Schedule 9, List 2, Item 1 provides that states have the authority relating to creation and punishment of offences by persons professing the religion of Islam against, again the important word, precepts of that religion. Islamist ideologues have pushed for an interpretation of precepts of the religion to mean any matter that can be regulated by Islamic teachings, thus expanding its jurisdiction to include matters under federal control, such as crime. Crime is a federal matter in Malaysia, where Islamic teachings too have prescribed forms of punishment. Even though the constitution is explicit that state jurisdiction does not include matters included in the federal list, and criminal law and procedure are in the federal list according to the under the constitution, and therefore is outside the legislative competence of state governments, this of course did not stop the Islamists. Second, the penalties under Hudud law, such as amputation and flogging up to 100 lashes, are unconstitutional, as the law, the Sharia Courts Criminal Jurisdiction Act, actually imposes limits on the Sharia courts, limits on jail terms and fines that the Sharia courts can impose, which is 3 years jail, 5,000 Malaysian ringgit fine, and 6 lashes. Any penalty other than these permitted penalties is unconstitutional. It is clear that the Hudud laws in the two states, Kelantan and Terengganu in Malaysia, passed by the state legislative assemblies under the Islamic Party, are unconstitutional. The federal government also made its opposition clear. Therefore, the past state government has never tried to enforce the laws they passed. Maybe they never intended to. But the past leadership argued that it was their religious duty to bring about God's law to administer the land under the control. And since the federal government was opposed to it, the burden of sin then lay with the federal government, not the past government. In the eyes of the past supporters, the party has fulfilled its obligations in promising to rule by Islamic law, no matter if the law was unconstitutional and unenforceable. And yet, even though the federal government has won back one of the state governments in the 2004 elections, it has had no political courage to repeal the Hudud law, which remains on the statute books. The one attempt to challenge the law on constitutional grounds in the federal court has been withdrawn because of political pressure. As with the Hudud law in Pakistan, once a law in the name of Islam is put in place, politicians do not have the stomach to repeal the laws, no matter how unjust or unconstitutional. In the recent case in Pakistan, what the government did was to introduce a new law on women's protection that made the Hudud law actually unenforceable, but the Hudud law remains in the statute books. For constitutional lawyers in Malaysia, the case of the Hudud law is clear and simple. It is unconstitutional on several grounds. But again, no one has the political courage to challenge this for fear of being accused of being against Islam or Islamic law. The second area of contestation I want to cite is the debate on freedom of religion. And this takes place in Malaysia at several levels. First, at the theological level, between those who believe in freedom of religion in Islam, based on the Quranic verse that there can be no compulsion in religion, and the fact that in some 20 verses in the Quran on the subject of apostasy, the Quran does not provide any form of punishment in this life. and those who use the tradition of the prophet to demand death penalty for apostasy. Second, at the political level, the Islamic Party PAS, in its Hudud law, has prescribed death penalty for those who leave Islam. And is in its attempt over several years to introduce a private member's bill in parliament to prescribe death for apostasy. The PAS demand for capital punishment has of course been challenged by progressives, by human rights activists, who are opposed to any form of punishment on Islamic or constitutional grounds. In the middle is the position of the religious authorities in government that prescribes mandatory detention for rehabilitation for a period of 1 year for those who want to leave Islam. For human rights activists, of course, this is no compromise, as this violates several fundamental freedoms under the Constitution. The debate on freedom of religion also takes place at a third level, the jurisdictional level. The Constitution recognizes freedom of religion as a fundamental liberty, and therefore any dispute over the matter should be heard by the federal court. But the Sharia law proponents argue that whether a person believes or disbelieves is a precept of Islam. And using the implied jurisdiction argument, they argued that the right jurisdiction and authority to decide on the matter must be in the Sharia court. And because conversion into Islam is a Sharia matter, therefore they argued anyone who wants to leave Islam must get the permission of the Sharia court, and the Sharia court has the power to punish those who want to leave Islam. In the celebrated case, I don't know whether you're familiar with the case of Lina Joy, a woman who was born a Muslim and who wanted to leave Islam. The Supreme Court, now it's called the Federal Court, but it is equivalent to your Supreme Court, in its judgment seemed to imply that while Lina Joy had the right to leave Islam, she has to get an exit certificate to leave Islam. And she has to get that from the Sharia court first. This was the majority decision of the Supreme Court. The dissenting judgment, only one judge dissented, argued, however, among other things, that Lina Joy cannot be expected to present her case for adjudication in the Sharia court, where state laws make it a crime for a person who attempts to leave Islam, thus thwarting the exercise of her constitutional right to freedom of religion. Moreover, in cases where Muslims have gone to the Sharia court for an exit certificate, most judges have refused to hear the cases or grant an exit certificate, perhaps because of a personal belief that they would be committing a grave sin in allowing a person to leave Islam, or that they judge that this was not a genuine case of a change of faith. A more recent federal court judgment affirming the limits of Sharia jurisdiction stated that the jurisdiction of the Sharia court can only be discerned from written law and not through implied jurisdiction. This means that unless and until a law is made, the Sharia court has no jurisdiction. Just because the matter before the court is deemed to be a precept of Islam. This judgment has implications on cases on freedom of religion, where the courts, as I said, have used the implied judgment argument to hold that a Muslim needs to get an exit certificate from the Sharia court. But this new federal court judgment remains to be tested in an appeal case. Let me now go to the example of the third area of contestation, the issue of women's rights. Even though the Constitution recognizes all citizens are equal before the law, entitled to equal protection of the law, and forbids discrimination on the grounds of gender, this guarantee does not invalidate or prohibit any provision regulating personal law. Who decided then that in the realm of the private, human rights violations are legitimate? In practice, this exception to equality and non-discrimination means that in the name of religion and custom, women can be discriminated against. This is, of course, not peculiar only to the Malaysian Constitution. In other jurisdictions, in the name of freedom of religion and multiculturalism, minority communities are allowed to govern the personal status of their faith groups, even if they violate fundamental rights. The main area of infringement of the fundamental human right to equality is in the area of Islamic family law. As long ago as 1976, the law on marriage and divorce for non-Muslims in Malaysia underwent a major reform to establish equality within the marriage and equality at divorce. But more than 30 years later, Muslim women continue to face several areas of discrimination in their personal status. They still do not enjoy equal right to marriage, divorce, guardianship, and inheritance, while their fellow citizens of other faith have benefited from major advancements in our struggle for equality and justice. Not only that, trends in Muslim law reform in the 1990s and 2000s have been regressing, chiseling away at rights granted under the original Islamic family law in 1984, making divorce and polygamy easier for men. Under this, I'll just quickly go through some of the major areas of discrimination. A man can divorce his wife at will, but a woman has to go to court and obtain a judicial divorce. A woman is supposed to obey her husband, and her failure to comply with the lawful wishes of her husband constitutes nushuz, disobedience, and she can lose her right to maintenance. A man has a right to four wives. A woman is not entitled to the guardianship of her children. She can get physical custody of her children only up to the age of 7 for a son and 9 for a daughter. Custody then reverts to the father. The one positive amendment in the 1990s was to enable women to maintain custody of the children if she can prove that it is in the best interest of the children for the children to remain with the mother. Thus, even while the woman has physical custody of the children, guardianship still lies with the father, who maintains control over matters where the consent of the guardian is required. Example, permission to obtain a passport, to travel overseas, to register for school, to change school, to undergo surgery, and ownership and disposal of the children's property. While a woman can lose her right to custody of her children, the man never loses his right to guardianship, even if he has been an irresponsible guardian, or in most cases, a missing guardian. While the Guardianship Act was amended to grant non-Muslim mothers equal right to guardianship of their children, the right was not extended to the Muslim mothers who remain discriminated in the name of Islam. Of course, the other area of discrimination is the issue of inheritance, where a daughter inherits half of what the son gets, and a woman's right to inherit from her husband's estate is also less than a husband's portion of inheritance upon the death of his wife. While the Distribution Act for non-Muslims has been amended to grant non-Muslim women equal right to inheritance. This principle of difference between Muslim men and women also affect other areas of law reform in Malaysia. For example, in the Campaign for the Domestic Violence Act, the religious authorities in Malaysia wanted to exclude Muslims from the jurisdiction of this act, which makes domestic violence a crime. And the objections were twofold. First, it was argued by its opponents that, what constitutes violent under Islamic law, what does not constitute violent under Islamic law under the Domestic Violence Act constitute violence, implying that domestic violence may constitute a crime if committed by non-Muslims but not by Muslims. Second was a question of jurisdiction, that domestic violence is a family matter and not a crime, and therefore should come under the Sharia jurisdiction of each state and not under federal jurisdiction under the Penal Code, which comes under federal jurisdiction. Similarly, with amendments to the Guardianship of Infants Act, in early 1999, the Guardianship of Infants Act was amended to give non-Muslim mothers the equal right to guardianship of their children. But the law does not accord the same rights to Muslim mothers. And the minister in charge of women's affairs then said, since Muslim women's right to guardianship came under the Islamic family law, the amendment would apply only to non-Muslims, end of problem. No attempt was made to ensure that Muslim women would benefit equally in this decision to promote the rights of women in Malaysia by amending laws that discriminate against women. Why this treatment of Muslim women as third-class citizens of the country when Muslim women were equally involved in the campaign to amend the Guardianship Act to grant all women equal right to guardianship? Within the context of multi-religious countries with plural legal systems, amendments to civil law to end discrimination against women very often leave behind Muslim women on issues which come under Sharia jurisdiction. The amendment to Article 8 of the Federal Constitution to prohibit discrimination on the basis of gender now poses a special challenge to the Sharia court and the Islamic religious authorities to take steps to end all forms of discrimination against Muslim women in law and in practice committed in the name of Islam. The right to equality before the law and equal protection of the law and the right to non-discrimination on the basis of gender are constitutional guarantees for all Malaysians, all citizens to enjoy, be they Muslim or non-Muslim. But women's groups are still battling constitutional provisions that allow for customary and religious laws to govern the personal status of the community on the basis of cultural and religious freedoms and diversity. This legal conception, the problem we're facing is that legal conceptions of culture and gender are viewed both aesthetic and homogeneous, and really ignoring the dissenting voices that are emerging within the community, especially women's voices, which are contesting the dominant idea that in the name of culture and religion, women can be discriminated against. Given all these problems, I think I will end soon so that there'll be a bit more time for you to ask me questions and to comment. Given all these problems, conflict, contradictions, and political tightropes that the government has to walk, some of you might have come to the conclusion that religion has no place in public life, that a strict separation of church and state, religion and politics is the only way out. Or for some of you, the case I have made before you only reaffirms prejudices and belief in an Islam that is inherently unjust and oppressive. So why bother to engage with Islam? But these are not key debates in many Muslim countries. First, that Islam is a source of law and public policy is a given in many Muslim countries. The more important contestation that is taking place within the Muslim community is taking place at the level of the internal debate within Islam. What Islam? Whose Islam is the right Islam? Which teaching of Islam should be a source of law and public policy? Which teaching should be codified into positive law? The teaching that recognizes freedom of religion, which exists within Islam, or the teaching that demands death penalty for those leaving Islam? The teaching that recognizes equality and justice as the objective of Sharia, and you saw that clearly in the verses in the Quran, or the teaching that demands women to be treated as inferior to men? Second, what are the limitations on the place of Islam in public policy within the context of constitutional democratic governance, international human rights conventions that many Muslim governments have put their signature to, and most importantly, of course, within the context of the changing lived realities of Muslims, in particular of Muslim women today? And in this debate, I must assert that I do not believe that Islam is inherently the problem. The problem is not so much with religion, but with those in power, those who control the teachings of the religion, who insist on making criminal what they believe to be sinful in order to command compliance with religious teachings, or to use religion to maintain patriarchy and men's privileged status in the private and public spheres in the face of changing realities of women's lives in the modern world. And Musawwa really is an attempt of really bringing together all these women's groups in Muslim societies all over the world who've really been struggling for decades to push for reform, to push for equality, to push for justice for Muslim women, and facing this resistance in the name of religion. And you can see in Malaysia, we really have the peculiar situation where law reform is taking place, granting equal rights between men and women, non-Muslim men and women, and, you know, maintaining the inequality between Muslim men and women in the name of religion. And really for us, in my group, Sisters in Islam, this is really totally untenable. And, you know, in being a part of Musawwa, in creating this very public international voice, you know, what Muslim women are telling their governments, their religious authorities, enough is enough. We're not going to take this silent anymore. Thank you.